accession number 12268, Mr. Charles Biedman, reel 2.
Charles Biedman, reel 2. Yes, you've arrived in Durban.
The South Africans were hospitality itself, and they had quite a bit to put up with, because suddenly a convoy of men arrived, most of whom were due for the Middle East, who had been at sea for some weeks, and I don't think I've ever seen quite so many drunken men. The army trucks and service trucks were just load them in and take them back to barracks. But it really, in a sense, was relief of tensions. And I didn't hear of any man that was charged. And we seemed to settle back in the conditions quite well. There's always a great deal of humour in the services, which probably helps to make life tolerable. And I can remember we had a rather smallish battery sergeant major called Goss, and I met him the morning after we'd landed in Durban. And he said, "I just don't know what happened to me last night, you know, but," he said, "I can hardly walk." So on the spur of the moment, I said to him, "Well, the these rickshaws, the Zulus, pull, and these Zulus, very tall men, they were something like about 6.5 feet. And I said, "You know, you were putting a rickshaw with a Zulu sitting in the back." Well, this was made up on the spur of the moment, and if he's still alive, he probably still tells the story. And the astounding thing is there was at least 20 people who verify the story. So that helped sort of smooth our life quite a lot. We left Durban on an army supply ship called the Dunera, D-U-N-E-I-R-A. And this had Alaska crew. They want an explanation of Alaskas, do they? Alaskas were, in the main, Indians, Pakistanis, they could be Arabs, etc. It was absolutely spotless. We had all our guns mounted on this Dunera, as this was the flagship of our convoy going out to Far East. So that we must have had something like 12 guns, which would have given us a lot of firepower. We had fairly constant instruction and lots of gun drill, which we enjoyed because we were shooting at various targets. And as stated before, they were trying to introduce us to the Japanese. And we were told that the Japanese Air Force was nothing at all, that their planes were inferior, and the Japanese, as a race, were myopic, and that really, it should be just a doddle to shoot them out of the sky. Well, it may be an aspect of instruction to divide your enemy. But I think personally, it achieved the reverse of what was intended, because when we did meet up with the Japanese, the shock was all that much greater. Because they are fine service people, there was nothing wrong at all with their airplanes. In fact, the Navy Zero, which was their fighter plane, was first rate. But this was the type of instruction that we're given, plus an awful lot of lectures on recognition of the various Japanese planes.
Do you think that was related, that sort of, those remarks about the Japanese? Was it related to a particular attitude towards other races in the army, would you say?
Yes, there is a tendency in the British Army to have something of a superiority complex. And of course his traditions are fine, but it's never wise to underrate your enemy. Because otherwise, as I've said, the shock can be all that much greater when you come up against reality. We were due for Singapore, but before we got there, the Japanese had sunk two of our battleships. I think they were the Prince of Wales and Minnown. This created a great shock all around the world, because I think it was Churchill himself who had ordered them to be diverted out east. And it was the first time, I believe, that battleships had been sunk by any air force.
So that before... It's interesting, in the light of what you've been saying earlier, Charles, I wonder if it made you reconsider the information you'd been given about the Japanese Air Force, the fact that they had sunk those battleships.
Well, obviously. The truth about the Air Force, the different Air Forces, was simply that in Singapore, they had very ancient planes like the Walrus, which were a delight to see, but were so slow that they were practically of no use whatsoever for war purposes. Hurricanes and hurricane parts had been sent out, but they hadn't been adapted for tropical conditions, and there really was no time at all to put them right. So in effect, the Japanese achieved air superiority very quickly indeed, and that of course made a difference. By this time, although I didn't get to Singapore or Malaya then, there was a great fear of the Japanese, because in actual fact we had more men in Singapore than the whole of the invading Japanese army. Services that were out east were rather enervated. They had a very easy life, whatever your rank. There were plenty of servants about, and life and living were cheap. There was also a tendency to live it at a very comfortable level, so that you probably did a few hours work in the morning and that was the finish of the day, and then spent the heat of the day probably resting. Well, the Japanese were a very different kettle of fish. They were well trained, completely self-reliant. If you gave a Japanese a bag of rice and a few essentials, he was quite happy to look after himself for considerable periods. And they fought their campaign down Malaya by getting behind the British lines, and could stay, and did stay, all day long in paddy fields, immersed up to the neck in water. And this is no joke, because you get all sorts of leeches and snakes, rats in paddy fields. So I don't think you'd have easily have got Europeans or British soldiery to have done the same thing. Another thing which seemed to scare people was that the Japanese tend to use sandals quite a lot, and they often used platform sandals, and their only grip on the sandals was a peg which fitted between the big toe and the next toe. Well, when they went in the services, the Japanese army fitted them with sneakers, and these were made the same way. Their big toe was separated from the rest of the foot. So it gave, and these were almost always black. In fact, I don't think I ever saw any other colour black. But it gave the effect of being a cloven hoof. Whether this was deliberate by the Japanese hierarchy, I don't know. I suspect not. I think it's just simply that this was comfortable for the Japanese. They're accustomed to use their big toe separate from the rest of the foot. But they were devilish. They looked different. And they were fighting the war on guerrilla terms. So they came down Malaya very fast indeed. They were also prepared to work and fight all day long. In fact, one of the things we found difficult to accept once we were taken prisoners in Java was that they made us work during the heat of the day, whereas previously the Dutch and ourselves had considered this a resting period. The Japanese are hard-working people, and this didn't interest them. So that they were well-led, a good army, and they were facing an enemy who was running scared. The only regiment in the British services that didn't surrender were the Gurkhas. And after Singapore had fallen, the Japanese put them all into the Gurkha regiments into a football field, and they died in hundreds of dysentery, but never gave in. So that later on, when they were in the established prisoner of war camps, whenever the Gurkhas appeared, the rest of the British soldiery would stand to attention and salute them. And after the war, they were given the highest honours and are now an integral part, an equal part of the British Army. Equally, the Sikhs went over to the Japanese. And the reason for this, I think, was that India was fighting a battle of independence. I don't think they had any enormous dislike of the British. It's just that they felt this would help their cause quite a bit. We did send one battery into Singapore, didn't go into action particularly, and managed to escape. and we ourselves were diverted to Java, to Batavia, which was the capital town. It was an interesting and exciting place, quite oriental, and as the Japanese were still many, many hundreds of miles away, there was no real feeling of war whatsoever. The Dutch, too, suffered from the same effects as the British, that they were colonial, had an extraordinarily easy life, and were not really geared up for any war whatsoever. A large part of the army too was half-caste or Javanese. The Dutch themselves had no colour bar, so that you had a lot of these half-caste and coloured people at all levels in the services. I did, particularly on one occasion, meet quite an aspect of bravery in one of these half-castes. So I wouldn't say they were any worse than anybody else, but obviously their interest was Java and not Holland, because most of them had no conception at all, and I don't think they really appreciated their second-rate citizenry.
What was that example of bravery you experienced?
There's a lot further on in Japan. Do you want me to put it in there?
You could give it now, because it would fit in with a theme.
In Japan, we were housed in quite a small camp, and it wasn't well heated. In fact, the only heating was by hibashis, which are very small fireplaces burning charcoal. These are generally square and might well be 5 or 6 feet square, and the charcoal is put on sand and heated, but this wasn't kept up at any tremendous temperature during the night, so that people, the men would go down to latrines. And some men, because of the rice diet, would have to go down perhaps 2 or 3 times a night. And this particular building, which had been a YMCA building, was built on top of a hill, so there were several flights of stairs down, or steps, down to these latrines. And it was an order that any time you passed a Japanese soldier, you bowed in respect to him. And one or two of the Japanese soldiers used to take advantage of this. And there was one man we didn't like particularly, we called Peg Leg, because he had an injury to his leg somewhere in China, and had been sent back to this more menial duty of looking after prisoners. And he kept himself in the shadows as such, and would catch unwary people who stumbled through the night and ask them why they hadn't bowed to him, and then would put them outside the guardhouse for several hours and probably beat them up just to show their superiority. On this occasion, this guard found a pool of water on the steps. They called the whole camp down for inspection. This was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and said that this was bestial behaviour, and that they would keep us standing there to attention until such time as somebody owned up to having committed this deed. Now, whether it was urine or water, I just wouldn't know. And we had been standing there almost to attention for something well over an hour when one of these half-caste Dutch people we had in the camp stepped forward. Now, I'm of the opinion that he did this because he realised the Japanese meant what they said and they would keep us there or punish us completely until such time as somebody owned up. And he would also known the dire consequences of such a confession. But he did step forward, and they eventually beat him to within an inch of his life. And we, when he came back, did the only thing, gave him the only thing we possessed, which was some cigarettes, and we collected as many cigarettes as we could, you know. And I always rate that as one of the bravest actions I ever knew, because he knew, with no doubt whatsoever, as we all did, exactly what the consequences of owning to that particular deed would be.
So, when did the war catch up with you then, you know, right, having gone to Java?
Right. We were suddenly ordered to go to Sumatra, because the Japanese by then had captured Singapore completely and had landed in Sumatra. We went to the southernmost port in Sumatra called Usthaven, and mounted our guns. There was a fair amount of panic, and I had the impression the Japanese weren't very far away. In actual fact, at that time, they were something like 200 miles away from us. The Dutch came in from all their plantations, etc., dumped whatever they had, and were happy to find any ship to take them away. We had a gun placed on the hill overlooking the harbour, and in actual fact blocked a pathway leading to the governor's residence, which was higher up this particular hill. His car couldn't pass the gun, so he left it in my charge. The only other sleeping accommodation we had were the trucks belonging to the gun. There was as much panic as this, because we had ample time really to put up accommodation for ourselves, but the impression was that we were going into action almost right away. I utilised the car for myself, and everything went quite well. It was very hot inside the car, and it kept the windows closed because of mosquitoes. About 2 o'clock in the morning, the car door was opened, and a fairly frightened gunner told me that there were tigers about. Well, Sumatra does have tigers. Whether they would come as close to habitation as it was another matter. However, I got up and in the process was stung all over the place, but amazing enough, I never contracted malaria, and probably something in my genes, because my brother who was in Africa was much the same boat and never had malaria. But it wasn't because I wasn't bitten by mosquitoes, because I had plenty. And certainly when I got to the gun, there were some funny sort of coughs and barks, etc. So I doubled the guard and gave them a machine gun and went back. Next morning we found that it was simply dogs from a little native village which was nearby. But when you've got steaming hot jungle all around you, it's quite easy to be scared at that time of the night.
What had happened in Sumatra, you know, regarding defences, apart from what you have described? Had the, you know, the population done much to defend?
No, the Dutch army really didn't fight. It's probably not fair to call them the Dutch army. I suppose they're the Dutch Far East Army, because, I mean, the Dutch, as they proved during the latter part of the war, were very fine soldiers. And as good as anybody in the world. But we ourselves, as a regiment, lost more men than the whole Dutch army. I believe the Dutch casualties were something under 300. There was just no fight, and the natives weren't interested. The Japanese propaganda, which they utilised right at the beginning, was Asia for the Asiatics, and this fitted in very well. And once the native problem realised that things went on, they still had electricity and they could still get water and the trains could run, they began to think to themselves, well, why have we been subservient to these Dutch for so many years, you know? And so this was it. And also the Japanese tended to put out high rewards for any British prisoners or people they might find, so that it virtually made escape impossible. In fact, I knew of nobody who escaped. The only escapees I did meet was a Captain Black and the companion, and Captain Black, I think, was in MI5. And he went into the jungle with a Dutchman who had lived in the jungle for years. So they were quite capable of living off the jungle, but they were constantly given away by the local Javanese or natives of Sumatra. So eventually they were captured as such. There virtually was no fight at all. My conclusion simply is that it's sensible, if you can, to keep out the first 6 months of any opening war. You've got to give it time to settle down. Eventually, when generals such as Ord Wingate came into being and trained our men hard, they were as good as the Japanese, and fought them back very hard indeed in Burma, Malaya, and etc. It is just perhaps this initial period which is always difficult. We never seem to learn the lessons of history, and defences are always put in the wrong place. In Singapore, all the massive guns were all pointed out the sea, because that's where the attack was going to come from. And once our capital ships had been sunk, there it was, and they came round the back. Well, nothing new in this. This has happened since time immemorial. But somehow human nature is such that when you get a period of peaceful existence, the old lessons are forgotten. So we ourselves went back to Java.
Was that was before the Japanese came?
Yes.
Presumably.
Yes. We were then sent up to Bandung, which was a delightful town in the mountains.